You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 3rd of April 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme...
We will prevent any act or any attack by the Taliban, and we will not allow Taliban to disrupt our election on that day.
Afghanistan's Interior Ministry spokesman there, James Boyes, and Daniela Pellad will discuss this and the rest of the day's biggest news stories with me a little later. After that, we'll be talking music. Watch that scene. For decades, Swedes, be they performers or producers, have managed to top the charts the world over. We'll speak to a journalist who thinks he knows the secret of the miracle of Swedish music. All that, plus we'll check in with our woman in Athens and get this week's top literary recommendations too. That is all coming up on this edition of Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Plenty to enjoy then in the next hour here on Midori House. Before we start all of that though, let's get the latest world news from Paul Osborne.
US military officials say the soldier who killed three of his comrades before taking his own life had showed no suicidal tendencies. But the man who had served in Iraq had been getting psychiatric treatment before Wednesday's attack at the Fort Hood base in Texas. In 2009, it was the scene of a mass shooting in which 13 people were killed. The Army's Chief of Staff, General Raymond Odinero, told a Senate committee that changes made since then undoubtedly saved lives.
I believe that some of the procedures that have been put in place following the incident 4.5 years ago did help us yesterday. The alert procedures that were in place, the response, the training that has gone into the response forces that responded, I think contributed to making this something that could have been much, much worse.
A report from Ukraine's Interior Ministry accuses Russian secret services of helping to plan a violent crackdown on anti-government protesters in Kiev. It says Ukraine's now disbanded riot police killed dozens of demonstrators. 12 people have been arrested. The inquiry claims responsibility for ordering the deaths goes as high as the deposed president, Viktor Yanukovych. The US Secretary of State has warned Israeli and Palestinian negotiators not to miss the opportunity for a lasting peace deal. Talks ran into trouble at the weekend when Israel refused to release a group of Palestinian prisoners. In response, the Palestinian president signed more than a dozen global treaties, something he had undertaken not to do during those talks. John Kerry says there's been a little progress since then, but said both sides must do more. Ballot boxes are being distributed across Afghanistan ahead of Saturday's presidential election. 11 candidates are standing, aiming to replace Hamid Karzai. But the Taliban has vowed to disrupt the poll and threatened to kill anyone taking part. Afghanistan's Interior Minister, Umar Dadzai, says he's confident voters will ignore the insurgents' threats.
Whether it's TTP or Taliban, they're all just brand names. It's the same thing. They're the enemies of people of Afghanistan. They don't want democracy to flourish here, and they don't want stability in Afghanistan to flourish.
Malaysia's Prime Minister says the international search for the missing flight MH370 has given us all heart. Najib Razak has been to Perth to meet officials who are leading the operation. He met Australia's Prime Minister Tony Abbott, both men saying they wouldn't give up looking for debris from the flight. Mr. Razak said he was overwhelmed by the efforts made to find the plane.
Hundreds of people have journeyed thousands of kilometers to help. They have searched through stormy seas and freezing fog. They have sailed through storms to find a plane. I know that until we find a plane, many families cannot start to grieve. I cannot imagine what they must be going through. But I can promise them we will not give up.
The United Nations has now registered more than 1 million Syrian refugees in Lebanon. They say refugees from the civil war there now account for 1/5 of Lebanon's population. In total, more than 2.5 million people have fled Syria in the 3 years since the uprising began against Bashar al-Assad's regime. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Paul. And Paul Osborne will return with the latest world news headlines for you at the bottom of the hour. Right now, though, 5 minutes past, you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, and we'll be back just after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 6 minutes past 1800 hours, 13:06 in New York City. Joining me now with their take on the news of the day here in the studio are both James Boyes, a senior fellow at King's College London, and Daniela Peled from the Institute of War and Peace Reporting. Welcome both to the programme. Great to have you with us, as always. I wanted to start with the news that broke relatively recently about Israel cancelling the release of Palestinian prisoners because of the continuing drive by the Palestinian authorities for recognition at the United Nations. We sort of delved into this the complexities of this topic so many times before. Daniela, just to start with you, though, I mean, are you surprised by this? Is this particularly bad news? Does it represent any significant change? Or is this yet another one of those things that perhaps we should have seen coming anyway?
It's not a surprise that the talks are going to break down, but it's a particularly inelegant way for it to happen. Because Israel, let's be clear, agreed to release these prisoners quite a while ago. And although they are guilty of some heinous crimes, they've all been in prison since before the Oslo Accords. This is something they committed to do. The problem is that the settler-led party, Habayit Yehudi, in government was very much against it. So I think Netanyahu had to consider the safety of his coalition as opposed to the end of the talks. But a surprise? No, not a surprise.
And James, we've had Zippy Livni saying that Palestinian actions have violated conditions for the release. Do you sort of share Daniela's viewpoint there that that's not really what this is about?
Yeah, I think we need to be careful about this. I think all too often we look at these issues and see it in a straightforward foreign policy perspective. And it's important, I think, to recognise that there are domestic pressures here and to recognise the impact of the domestic upon the foreign. And I think all too often we ignore that. My wife's actually just written a piece for the LSE blog on this very, very subject today, talking about the role of Secretary Kerry in all this, and about, you know, his ongoing quest for supposedly a Nobel Peace Prize, and that looks like it's going to evaporate, I think, which I'm sure he'll be very disappointed about. But I don't think anybody would be really surprised that the Israelis have acted in this fashion.
What should the main actors do next then, Daniela, if anything? It's interesting, I mean, James mentions John Kerry and his admirable efforts. We've complimented him on racking up his air miles.
Netanyahu every day, apparently.
Well, exactly, but it doesn't seem to be getting anywhere, or it's actively going nowhere, I should say. What do people do next?
Right, it's very clear what the Palestinians do now. And to be fair, this is probably in their better interest than continuing the negotiations. They've already applied to join 15 UN bodies. There's a 500 odd left for them to apply. What they're going to do now is they're going to go back to the UN, the General Assembly, in September, and they're going to ask to be upgraded, their status to be upgraded again. Now, the General Assembly will support them. The Security Council is a different matter. If America abstains on that decision and does or doesn't use its veto, then we could see Palestine as an independent state. Now, the Israelis are already massing around this, calling this diplomatic terrorism, but no one will buy that. I think the world pretty much accepts Palestine as a country, except one with undefined borders. The Israelis don't have an answer to this. There's no diplomatic strategy to counter this.
Do you think we'll see that happen?
Well, the great question, again, you know, coming back to my initial point, we need to consider the impact of the domestic upon the foreign. If this was just a question of looking at things in isolation, that would be one thing. But Stanley Wright points out, the idea here is that you're going to have a potential veto by the United States with regards to this. It's always an election cycle in the United States. The administration will need to be thinking about the important impact of the Jewish vote within the American electoral situation. Will it stand idly by and allow this to happen? One has to question that, I think, at this point. And it's probably a little bit too early to tell what exactly it will do if and when it comes to a vote at the Security Council.
We're going to talk about Afghanistan in a moment, and I wanted to ask you at that point, James, about sort of the appetite for US foreign policy at home. But just on this issue, specifically the kind of Israel-Palestine question, characterise, if you can, what you make of the domestic US view on this issue then. As you mentioned, sort of electoral cycles, you look ahead to 2016.
Well, in 2014.
It's for 2014, sorry. What do you think the sort of appetite is for even to sort of discuss this issue? Are people just weary of it?
Well, I think there's a generally held perception with United States domestic politics, which is that you never go too far wrong by being too strong a supporter of Israel. In whatever part of the country you're in, quite frankly, there really isn't a strong Palestinian lobby, for example, in the US. So if you want to be thinking about how to play it safe, you know, you should basically put your money on the fact that when push comes to shove, the United States will side with Israel. Its domestic politicians will do the same. It's fundamentally where the money comes from with regard to supporting supporters. There are key states in the United States. You know, one thinks of New York, Florida, California. You know, the big key states that you need the Electoral College votes to win, which have, you know, a big Jewish community, which are going to basically support American domestic politicians. So I think if you look at that basis, it's clear to see, I think, why it is that it's possible that the Palestinians get a poor rub from the United States generally.
I think it's also important to note that the Jewish community in America is on Israel-Palestine, broadly supportive of Israel, but also quite left-wing as far as the spectrum goes. So the fact that American policy might seem as if it's bending towards Palestine isn't necessarily a negative thing. I mean, they're still supporters of the two-state solution, which might seem a little anachronistic for some observers of the conflict. But yeah, a move by America towards supporting a Palestinian state, not necessarily a vote loser amongst Jews.
Let's talk a little then about Afghanistan. I mentioned there the presidential elections obviously forthcoming, taking place this weekend, the first democratic transfer of power, one hopes, in the country's history. Talk about the specifics in a minute, but James, I guess just picking up on that, the US angle, what do you think the legacy is, or is it too early to say in any sort of enduring terms about the sort of whole US-Afghan incursion? It was interesting. It was the first month where there were no deaths, I believe, of serving troops from the US this past month. What's the picture like in the US? And do you think we'll see that, you know, at the ballot box this year and in 2 years' time?
The picture in the US?
Yeah, in terms of just the appetite for that sort of engagement. Does this represent a sort of a stopping point, do you think?
Yeah, I think there generally is a lack of an appetite for this. I think that if you think about why Afghanistan happened, it happened in direct reaction to the events of September 11th, as opposed to Iraq, which was obviously a very, very different situation. I think there was a recognised need to do something after September 11th. The move into Afghanistan was justified on that basis. I don't think anybody expected necessarily that the Americans would still be there over a decade later on, least of all the Americans, quite frankly. If you look at the history of this administration, it's been one of trying to close down foreign escapades in Iraq, Afghanistan. It has been, therefore, one of the main reasons you've not seen a push to drive into places like Libya, Egypt, or in particular into Syria. And I think that's reflecting the mood of the American people, quite frankly. You don't have an appetite for continued incursion by the American people. You certainly don't see it in the administration. And the last thing Barack Obama wants, I think, is to engage further. He's seen his entire administration as being one which is withdrawing from trouble spots in the world. And I think you're not going to see any further incursions during his remaining time in office.
That may well be the case, Daniel. Would you agree with that, first of all? And also, what do you think we'll see from whoever's in the White House then in a couple of years' time? More of the same? Do you think that it will reflect this broad shift in US appetites for being involved, the world's policeman, this kind of thing?
Well, as far as Afghanistan is involved, it depends very much on the bilateral security agreement, which the next president of Afghanistan will have to sign. Now, this all hinges on whether American troops are going to be able to remain in Afghanistan. They'll only do that if they're offered immunity from prosecution. Now, this is something that Karzai has kicked along the road. He doesn't want to sign it. The next president will sign it. But if no American troops are left in Afghanistan, this does bode rather ill. I think many Afghans, as much as they don't want to see foreign troops in their country, are aware that security support is really necessary.
Let's look at that in a bit more detail then. James, what are you sort of expecting to see in the sort of aftermath of this election? We know that the sort of Taliban are committed to do all they can to destabilize the process, intimidate voters fairly on a fairly widespread basis. Is it I don't know, pie in the sky to think that we could see a more stable Afghanistan as a result of what we see happening in this vote.
Yeah, I think most people have long given up upon the idea of any sort of Jeffersonian democracy taking root in Afghanistan. I think it's important to note, coming back to something you were saying a minute or two ago, the United States has long since given up on being the idea of the world's policeman. I mean, going back to Bill Clinton's time in office, something I've written about extensively, this idea that America has gone through the Cold War merely to emerge as the world's policeman has long gone out the window. The events that take place in Afghanistan were a direct response to a specific attack. Iraq was an ongoing mission, effectively, by a certain group within the Republican Party. And I think you've seen a move across the board, both Democrat and Republican, actually, to move away from concepts of going around the world and trying to impose democracy, effectively. I think whatever comes out of this, I don't think anybody in the West is going to be too sorry to see the back of Hamid Karzai. I think some of the statements he's come out with in terms of being somewhat less than grateful, perhaps, for the blood and treasure which have been spilt in that country are problematic. But I think that whatever comes out of this, you know, we're going to see a regression, I fear, because there's no appetite in the United States to leave a large body of contingent troops in that country. And as I fear, you're going to get a move back to a situation which was not too dissimilar from the situation which we found Afghanistan on September 10th, 2001.
Yeah, well, we've kind of seen that before in Afghanistan over mm-hmm. a sort of generation.
Absolutely.
You mentioned there this is sort of the end of Karzai, but it may not be the end of the Karzai collective, the clan, the family. There's other sort of elements who are standing for election, who are still connected to him, his anointed successors, this kind of thing. What do we know, Daniela, about these leading candidates, if you like, for this election this weekend? Will we still see one of Karzai's, you know, preferred people in the big chair? Or could we see someone a bit different? I mean, is there such a thing as a unity candidate in Afghanistan? Or is that whole concept essentially meaningless in that particular political theatre?
Well, I don't know about unity candidate. I mean, there's a field of eight, which include their own share of warlords and former warlords, especially in the positions of vice presidents. There are three front runners: Abdullah, who came second in the last elections, Ashraf Ghani, and Zalmay Rasul. Now, these three are all pretty much acceptable to the West. They're all doctors, whether of medicine or anthropology. I wouldn't say unity candidate. I mean, these are sort of political operators, technocrats. The one closest to Karzai is Zalmay Rasul, who accompanied him, who's his former foreign minister, accompanied him on every foreign trip, but he's the one lagging behind. Abdullah, who decided not to fight the runoff in the last election because of allegations of fraud, is already raising the idea of fraud, I think somewhat disingenuously. Does it preparing the ground in case he doesn't win? But look, everything is to play for. What's interesting is we really don't know who's going to win. And also it's fairly unlikely that any one candidate will win more than 50% in the first round. In any case, it will take weeks to count the votes. Mm-hmm. So this process could drag on through the summer, through the fighting season for the Taliban, instability to come for a while yet.
And where will that lead us then if we go out to the sort of the other side of that fighting season, as you allude to there? Where does this leave us in, you know, 6 months or a year's time? You mentioned that these candidates are broadly sort of acceptable to the West, but they're not exactly inspirational figures. And as you sort of also alluded to, there are various questions about them, which you imagine the defeated may raise of the successful winner of this election. Is there any chance for someone to actually sort of seize the initiative here and actually start to deliver some meaningful change? Or is it almost a poison chalice? I mean, James, what do you think?
Well, I think the great risk here is how do you develop and build upon the power base that supposedly is in place at the moment? I mean, time and time again, we hear reference to President Karzai, but, you know, how much of a hold does he have across the rest of the country? I mean, I've heard him referred to repeatedly as almost like the mayor of Kabul, for example. Mm. But once you get beyond that area, how much control does the president of the country have upon the rest of Afghanistan? And if Karzai, who's been in power, you know, for this amount of time, has struggled to impose his will upon that, how can a group of disparate candidates who Daniela Wright refers to as almost a choice of also-rans, effectively, possibly do that? I mean, they're nondescript technocrats, you know. How are you going to basically move and impose your will on that position? The problem is, of course, is that the United States really doesn't want an iron strongman in there. You know, we've tried that role before, and, you know, we've seen how that works out. So the problem is, though, if you have a series of relatively small, inconsequential individuals, how do you possibly then impose a national will? And I don't know if anybody quite has the answer to that.
Well, I would be wary, though, of dismissing democracy or the appetite for democracy in Afghanistan. It's traditionally long been a difficult place to govern centrally. It's ethnically diverse, geographically diverse. Also important to note, as well as presidential elections, these are elections for the provincial council. There's nearly 3,000 candidates, more than 10% of whom are women. Perhaps on a local level, this is going to have more effect than who calls the shots in Kabul. And voter registration is much higher than before. I heard a story from Andar district in Ghazni province in the south. The last election, three people voted across the whole district. That's three. This time, according to the Independent Electoral Commission, 9,000 people have registered to vote. And I think that's significant. I think it says something about the appetite of people who live in Afghanistan to take control of the future of their country.
And just on that point, you don't think we in the West slightly fall into the trap of saying only three here, now 9,000 or 10% female candidates? These are obviously encouraging numbers, but is there a risk that perhaps we look at this and use these numbers to comfort ourselves, or certainly some actors in the United States use them to comfort themselves that, you know, there were things that were accomplished here that will have lasting benefits?
Yeah, you know, it's funny, as you were asking the question before you got to the punchline, effectively, I was actually sitting here thinking, you know what, deep down in Texas somewhere, somebody will be thinking, well, gee, you know what, this is all great, this is because of democratic promotion and yada 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 yada, we were right. You know, it's perhaps too early to tell, you know, has democracy been exported to Iraq and Afghanistan? You know, who knows at this point, quite frankly? What's that old line about, you know, the aftermath of the 100-year war? It's too early to tell. And I think there's a degree of that which is going to be going on here. We'll be looking at this for many years to come. And yes, I hope Daniela is absolutely right. You know, we've got a huge upturn in voter participation. We've got women going to the polls, women participation. Fantastic. Let's hope it takes root and it isn't undermined by political violence.
A final thought from you, Daniela.
I think well, the lasting impression, what difference has been made in Afghanistan, is not because of our troops on the ground. It's what Afghan people have done themselves. That's the crucial element.
We're going to take a short break now on Midori House. Still with me are James Boyes and Daniela Pellett. We'll be hearing from them a little more in a moment when, amongst other things, we'll discuss the worsening situation of Syrian refugees in Lebanon and Iran's new UN ambassador, who's bringing yet another headache for the Obama administration. Stay tuned.
This week on the Foreign Desk, as India prepares to go to the polls in the world's largest ever election, we take a look at what's at stake.
People are fed up with corruption, people are fed up with price rise, the condition of hospitals, the conditions of schools, roads, all this.
I think Indian elections and Indian democracy are the greatest show on earth. The historian Ram Guha calls India the most interesting country in the world, and I think that as elections approach, it's very hard to disagree with him.
The power should come to the farmers, the peasants, laborers, executives, businessmen. Power should reach them.
A new prime minister will be elected, but what impact will he have on the rest of the world?
In some quarters in India, there is a feeling that the country could be a bigger player.
That's the Foreign Desk, an Indian election special this week on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24, ticking towards 24 minutes past the hour. Still with me, James Boyes and Daniela Pellett. Now, the UN announced today that the number of Syrian refugees in Lebanon has crossed a staggering 1 million. There doesn't seem to be an end to the flow of refugees from the country. It's interesting, James, isn't it? You mentioned Syria on your sort of list of countries where the appetite for US intervention had changed.
Sure.
Do these sorts of numbers change that? Does it cause any sort of ripples, you know, in the White House on the Capitol Hill? Because these numbers are, well, frankly, terrifying.
They are. And there will be certain people within the international relations community and the national security structure who will look at this and think this is terrible, we should do something. But I can guarantee you it won't be sufficient to drive policy forward to a point where really anything is done about this. Historically, there is a lack of appetite to do much during an election year in the United States. And the great problem with that, of course, is that every other year is an election year in the United States. It is a political system which is geared up far better for campaigning than for governing. And I think that one of the problems you're going to find is that, you know, there really is no domestic appetite either on Capitol Hill or within the country to get involved. You know, people like to be able to put things in simple black and white terms. And the problem is, where are the good guys in this at a simplistic level to sell it domestically to voters in Kansas who actually really matter? We far too often, I think, look at this and think, well, gee, you know, the United States needs to take a bolder lead on this. But as soon as you recognize the importance of Congress in getting consensus for foreign policy escapades, and you realize the need to get buy-in from the constituents, the more you realize why this is a very, very devilish situation for the Obama administration.
Daniela, if it's an impossible sell then domestically in the US, where do we look for solutions in terms of the Syrian crisis, which continues? I mean, the statistics are staggering. They're deeply concerning. Are there other easy... Well, probably there's no easy options. Are there other options at all that people should be exploring, perhaps?
I wish there were. I mean, I was a supporter in the past of intervention. I think the time has passed for that. Yeah. The danger of a million refugees in Lebanon is that Lebanon cannot cope. Lebanon is a country with its own sectarian tensions, which have been played out very much as a result of this. Like Jordan, which is also historically a country of refugees, there's limited resources. And so far, they've been pretty hospitable to the refugees. But there's got to be a limit. Now, again, I really resist any attempt to describe this as a humanitarian disaster, because it's not. It's a war. But I guess this is somewhere where the US can step up with humanitarian assistance to try and ease the tensions and the problems, because you have such a huge area of displacement. And this is not going to end anytime soon at all, at all.
Pretty bleak reading. Let's move on and talk briefly about Iran. The country's nominated Hamid Abu Talabi as its UN ambassador. The Obama administration's finding this understandably rather troubling, considering the very same man was apparently a member of the student group that took over the US embassy in Tehran, held American diplomats hostage back in the 1970s. James, how do these sorts of diplomatic befuddlements occur? Surely all the different actors in this should know this is going to cause a problem, and people should talk about it at some stage before it gets to this.
You would have thought, wouldn't you? Especially at this point in time where people are talking about a rapprochement between Tehran and Washington, D.C. You would have thought someone would have sat down in Tehran and thought, well, how will this play out? Especially having a Democrat in the White House. And of course, it was a Democratic administration of Jimmy Carter who got their hat handed to them effectively because of this situation. One really wonders who is thinking what, and whether this has an attempt to send a signal. It's entirely possible that people have just basically let this one slip and it's been a terrible mistake. But there's no doubt about it that it's an embarrassing situation. It doesn't exactly bode well for the ongoing negotiations. And it will, I think, be fuel to the bipartisan group of congressmen, particularly on the Senate, who view these ongoing negotiations as nothing more than a smokescreen from Tehran.
What do you make of it, Daniel? Do you think it is a considered gesture from Iran?
I wouldn't be at all surprised.
Is it an effective one if it is a considered, if it was a deliberate sort of attempt? Will it be effective?
Well, look, I mean, we've all got, certain quarters have got all quite excited about Rouhani and the rapprochement and happy days. The issue is that he faces quite a lot of opposition at home from hardliners. And this is quite a handy move. Even if it wasn't on purpose, I'm sure they're fairly happy that this has been revealed. After all, who wasn't there at the embassy siege? I mean, Ahmadinejad is apparently absolutely one of those callow youths as well. And this chap has got a very distinguished history in diplomatic service. He's supposed to be a moderate. So I think, I mean, if I was a survivor of the siege, I would also be annoyed, but I don't think this has any great consequences. You know, everyone has a history of sending people to the UN as a message. It's not really a direct comparison, but we remember who George W. Bush said to the UN, John Bolton, probably the most UN unfriendly ambassador ever.
So perhaps we should not be surprised. Is what I think. I sense what you're saying to me. Just before we end the show, I wanted to talk about a rather unlikely, but perhaps equally concerning implication from some of these various geopolitical spats that we've been discussing. Talking, of course, about Russia and asset freezes and the it bids to stop certain monies and peoples from moving around. Consider, if you will, the hapless residents of Helsinki, certainly the music enthusiasts in Finland. Number of the top names, and when I say top names, Miley Cyrus, Justin Timberlake amongst them, may not be able to perform in the Finnish capital due to international politics. Some of these Russian businessmen own these venues, and their names are included in a list of visa bans and asset freezes, which the US imposed against various allies of Putin last month. Okay, this is a fairly entertaining aspect of a very serious story, but does this show that actually the sort of the tentacles of these sorts of games affect all kinds of different businesses and a lot of different people on the ground who perhaps may not have anticipated that they were going to suffer in that way?
You're absolutely right. I mean, we're so used to talking about this in effectively hard power terms that we forget, you know, Joe Nye's classic concept of soft power. But soft power is a huge part of this. You know, so many people have compared what's happening recently with the old Cold War. So let's think about this in terms of 1980. The comparable probably will be with regard to what happened with the Olympics. So the Americans boycott the Moscow Games. Subsequently, the Soviets boycott the Los Angeles Games. And who suffers ultimately? You know, it's the people who want to see sport. It's the sportsmen in particular who trained for years who don't get to participate. You know, whether, you know, people not being able to see Miley Cyrus, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing.
It's
whether Putin's done everybody a big favour, I'm not sure. That's probably not my place to judge. But certainly the soft power element to this is something to be considered.
Daniel, final thought on this. You mentioned there, I'm not sure whether that was entirely serious or not, that it's a crime. What do you think? Should we spare a thought for our colleagues in Helsinki denied their favourites?
Well, I think it's rather piquant that this is probably going to have more of an effect via social media than the actual Ukraine crisis itself on a large number of people. It makes me think of Kim Kardashian getting involved in the Syrian civil war with her famous tweet about the plight of an Armenian village. Yeah, that's what it all comes down to, really. A misplaced Twitter, the big effect.
Those are the views of both Daniela Peled and James Boyes, my guests today on Midori House. Thank you both very much indeed for joining us on the programme.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 모노클 24입니다.
Od London, to my Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London,
dette Londres.
Hollanda.
London, London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
Plenty still to come in the second half of today's programme. We'll hear a theory explaining Sweden's incredible success in the music business. Check in with Monocle's Athens correspondent for the latest, and we'll get some great book recommendations for the week as well. Before all of that, though, let's get the latest world news headlines from Paul Osborne.
US military officials have said the soldier who killed three of his comrades and then took his own life at the Fort Hood base in Texas on Wednesday had showed no suicidal tendencies. But they say the man who'd served in Iraq had been getting psychiatric treatment. A report from the Interior Ministry in Ukraine says Russian secret services helped to plan a violent crackdown on anti-government protesters in Kiev in February. It says Ukraine's now disbanded riot police killed dozens of demonstrators. 12 people have been arrested. The US Secretary of State says Israeli and Palestinian negotiators cannot afford to miss the opportunity to agree a lasting peace deal. The talks ran into trouble at the weekend when Israel refused to release a group of Palestinian prisoners. In response, the Palestinian president signed more than a dozen global treaties, which was something he'd undertaken not to do during those talks. Ballot boxes are being distributed across Afghanistan ahead of Saturday's presidential election. Organisers say they're confident the poll will take place despite a threat from the Taliban to disrupt it and to kill anyone who takes part. And the United Nations has now registered more than 1 million Syrian refugees in Lebanon. They've said the refugees in the civil war now account for a fifth of Lebanon's population. In total, more than 2.5 million people have fled Syria since the start of the civil war 3 years ago. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Paul and Paul Osborne. We'll be back with a full bulletin of world news for you at the top of the hour. That's 1900 here in London. Right now, though, you're listening to Midori House, where it is time to check in on the big local discussion topics in one of the home cities of one of Monocle's many correspondents. Today, we're heading to Athens, where Natalie Savarakis is armed and ready with the week's top stories. Natalie, welcome to the programme. Great to speak with you, as always. Well, where else can we start other than with European finance. So what's the latest in Greece?
Well, we've got some positive news coming up. Just earlier this week, the European finance ministers approved an 8.3 billion euro tranche for Greece. That's much needed money, another loan, part of a loan actually, and it will help the country repay debt it owes in May. Now, additionally, what we're hearing is the Prime Minister recently announced that the country might be going back to the bond markets. It had been excluded from these markets since the crisis began a few years ago. So that is huge news, as it kind of shows some positive indications that Greece is again a credible partner for financial markets.
Intriguing stuff. I just wondered, I mean, do you think that Greece is actually inching towards, you know, being able to show that its economy is actually growing again? I mean, could we see that kind of turnaround?
Well, indeed. I mean, the government is prepared to announce that it will, I mean, the statistical authorities here, that for the first time after 6 years, it's going to have some growth. We're still unsure exactly how much that's going to be. It's still very small, but it's some sort of indication, at least for the authorities here, that the economy is turning around. Of course, the big question is if it's being felt by ordinary Greeks. They might have a disagreeing opinion.
Natalie, let's move on and touch on, well, another topic I guess we've discussed a few times with you here on the programme, about Golden Dawn and its travails, of course. But there's a bit of a scandal gripping, well, even some people quite close to the Prime Minister, isn't there, about links to that party, despite the arrests we saw and the ban that we've seen. How damaging might this prove to be?
It's pretty scandalous. I mean, what we heard is the Takis Paltakos, the Premier's aide, and as you said, government secretary general, is actually seen in this video having a very friendly conversation with the spokesman of Golden Dawn. And he's essentially saying that all the evidence used to prosecute the Golden Dawn leadership and MPs is unfounded, that the government intervened, meddled with the judiciary to make these arrests, and they did all this because of Golden Dawn's rising popularity. Now, this at the moment is the government is trying to, if you like, curtail the impact this could have. The Premier's aide resigned yesterday night, saying that he apologized for the trouble this has caused. Today he tried to justify his action, saying that he was doing it for the benefit of the party because it was losing many disenchanted conservative voters to Golden Dawn, and he was trying to regain these voters. Now, let's see how the government will manage this amidst an opposition party that is crying foul. It's calling for general elections, and even some voices in the coalition party, one of the parties that is part of the coalition administration, are now voicing their dissent and their disagreement, and are even calling for PASOK, the socialist party that is supporting New Democracy's rule, to leave the coalition government.
Natalie, let's finish by talking about, well, we'll leave politics far behind and instead let's go to the opera. The Maria Callas Museum is going to open its doors next year. Tell us about this announcement. Must have been greeted with a great deal of excitement, one imagines.
Absolutely. Just a few days ago, the municipality of Athens announced that they will be restoring a three-story building in the heart of Athens, and they will dedicate it to essentially the big Greek soprano Maria Callas. Now, although she's Greek-American, she was born in Manhattan, she was raised in Athens and received her musical education here. So, hearing them, they're just trying to see how best they can, if you like, show the great talent that this singer had. And they say that the big aim, if you like, of this museum is for the visitors, as they go in, to, if you like, enter a mystical universe where her voice will essentially dominate. And they will also try to transfer the visitor to an atmospheric environment where her image and theatrical performances will be displayed.
It sounds wonderful. We'll have to come and check that out when it opens. Natalie Savarakis, Monocle's Woman in Athens, thanks very much for bringing us up to speed. And, well, more music, not just Maria Callas, but we'll be discovering the secrets behind Sweden's phenomenal success in the global music market. Up next, on Midori House, right here on Monocle 24.
If you thought Vancouver fashion was just about open-toed sandals and fleeces, think again. Local clothing brands are on the rise, giving the city a stylish boost. Monocle Films headed to the West Coast to meet forward-thinking retailers.
We first opened this location in Chinatown in 2011, and it was really new at that time. There wasn't too much really going on in the neighborhood. We're pretty much one of the only ones on the block. But since then, it has grown quite a bit. It's become a really great little, kind of like if you know, then you know kind of places.
Fashion City, Vancouver. Now playing in the film section on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Now, from Ace of Base to the almighty ABBA, there's no shortage of chart-topping artists. From Sweden, the country is also the homeland of the most famous music producers in the world, who've been working with some of the biggest names in the business of late, Madonna, Britney Spears, Lady Gaga, Backstreet Boys, to name just a few. A little wonder, then, that Sweden is the largest exporter of pop music per capita, and the third largest overall. What can the reasons for this be? Well, our next guest argues it was the policies of the Swedish government back in the 40s that laid the foundations for the Swedish music industry to grow so successfully. To tell us a little more, I'm joined now on the line from Chicago by Wet Moser. Moser is the associate editor of Chicago Magazine, has written extensively about the topic. Wet, thank you very much indeed for joining us on the programme. Before, I guess, we talk about the reasons behind it, it's worth remembering, isn't it, the astonishing achievements by Swedish artists and particularly Swedish producers. It's pretty remarkable.
It really is. I was actually astonished to see that the two of the most successful acts in Billboard history were Ace of Base, and then their record was eclipsed later on by Katy Perry. And a lot of her, most of her largest hits have come from Swedish music producers.
And tell me a little bit about some of them, because the one I guess you allude to there is Max Martin, who worked with Ace of Base and, as you said, penned a number of Katy Perry's most successful records. I mean, how does someone like that do that? What do we know about Max Martin? Because there must be a bit of magic about the man as well as the country that he comes from.
He seems like a very shy person and tends not to court much media attention, so we don't know a great deal about him. We do know that he credits a lot of his success to the Swedish musical education system, that he got his start actually in glam metal, of all things, before he began working with Dennis Pop, the great Swedish music producer, kind of mentored Max Martin. We know that he likes to work in the minor key, and he's really good at writing ballads. And really just an incredible studio technician.
And tell me then a little bit about this background, because it is interesting, isn't it, that there's this sort of, well, in the 1940s, there was a particular sort of cultural conservatism that perhaps no one kind of expected would have given rise to such a sort of impressive creative force.
It is really surprising in the Swedish government sort of looked at this influx of popular music, and you know, like in a lot of cultures, it certainly happened in America. There was sort of this concern about what pop music was going to do to the kids, so they really encouraged people to pick up instruments and learn, you know, traditional forms of classical music and local folk music. But like a lot of culture in the 1960s and 70s, that sort of democratized as people began to embrace popular music as an art form and as a commercial form. And so they had sort of laid this groundwork in order to really kind of keep pop music away from kids. But as soon as that changed on a cultural level, sort of the cultural aesthetics of it, then that foundation was there for people to really start learning popular music.
And I just wonder, in terms of how this has been sustained, you know, into the more recent generations, are there any other factors that you've identified that play a role if we think the last sort of 10, 15 years? Because we often hear about the reasons that Sweden's very advanced and successful educational systems facilitate these kinds of successes in music and in all sorts of other areas. Are there other things particularly? I know that it's sort of a quick on the uptake approach to the world of digital has also played a part.
Yes, absolutely. Sweden has a really forward-thinking digital strategy for the country. Very early on, they had this, I don't believe this made it into the piece, they had this remarkable program where residents could actually lease computers from their places of employment. So they had very early uptake with personal computers and getting those connected to the internet. They have a really sophisticated rural broadband strategy that's really kind of a leader in the continent and also something that that people in the United States have sort of looked to. So they've really done an extraordinary job of getting people access to computers and getting them access to the internet. So there's very high computer literacy and technical literacy in the country. And another really significant aspect is Swedes speak English at very high rates. I believe among the highest in the continent. So if you're dealing with an international music audience, that's absolutely critical.
Well, I was going to ask you briefly about that as well, because obviously to be such a successful exporter, you've got to cultivate relationships. And there does seem to be a particularly strong bond between, well, Stockholm in particular, and the United States. Why do you think? Do you think that the Swedes just sort of understand the language, literally, of Americans, but also the language of American music, perhaps?
I think their high English literacy rates are absolutely critical to that. A lot of the Swedish songwriters are not just musicians and not just good at writing the music for American pop artists. They're also very good at writing the lyrics, and so both in working with the musicians with their product and working with the music industry on the back end, English literacy is incredibly important.
It's a fascinating relationship, and it was really interesting to hear your insights, Wet. That was Wet Moser from Chicago Magazine. Wet, thank you very much indeed for joining us here on Midori House. We should listen to some music now, of course, after hearing from Wet. And, well, we've got to keep it Swedish, haven't we, after that? So why not hear from Ace of Base with All That She Wants? And that was Ace of Base with All That She Wants, an old favourite here on Monocle 24. Right now you're listening to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards, and we're fast approaching the end of the programme. But before the top of the hour, we've still got plenty of time left for our daily review segment. We go through the best in books, theatre, art, music and cinema with various of our excellent all around the world. Today, though, we're talking books. And I'm delighted to say I've been joined right here in Studio One by Cathy Rensenbrick of the Bookseller Magazine. Now, Cathy joins me now. Cathy, welcome.
Hello.
Great to have you here, as always. Where shall we start today? How about with The Telling Error from Sophie Hannah? Give us a little bit of the background to this one, because there's some sort of interesting sort of other tales that go with this, aren't there?
Yes, I love Sophie Hannah. So she's a crime novelist. She's also a poet. She's also, I think, a very interesting social commentator. So this is a crime novel. I'm interested in general about how crime novels, I think, can be really good vehicles to explore social issues. And I think she does that particularly well in general. And she does it really well in this book, which is bang up to date in terms of how social media plays a role in the crime. So there's lots about Twitter. There's lots about how people forge relationships in the modern world in a not always very healthy way. There's a lot of stuff about illicit relationships online. So it's all extremely fascinating. The crime novel bit really works, but there's so much other food for thought in it.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because you have that those new sort of mediums that sort of exert such an intrigue over people.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no question that Sophie Hannah is quite a polished operator. So, you know, the classic storytelling elements, those strengths are there to see as well.
Yeah. So she's absolutely got all that stuff nailed down. But then I think she's a really interesting thinker. I think I always enjoy her blog pieces. She's a big Twitter user in the sense of I feel influential rather. The quality, not the quantity, is what I'm talking about. And I think it's really interesting to see her explore a lot of the issues that I've seen her talk about on Twitter, explore them, you know, more at length in this novel. And the main thrust of the novel is that it's a controversial journalist who's brutally murdered. And a lot of the suspects are people that he's engaged with on social media. He's been saying mean things about everybody. So there's no shortage of people that want to literally have a stab at him, and then it's all about finding out which one of them it's been.
A salutary lesson, perhaps, to some of the more sort of over familiar users of social media, perhaps. It's interesting though about Sophie Hannah. You mentioned some various of these, because she's one of these almost sort of insufferably capable people, a novelist, poet. She can write children's books, as you say, sort of social mm-hmm. commentary, a precocious talent as well. Some of her works have been turned into dramas for TV as well.
Yeah, she's writing Poirot, mystery.
There's nothing she can't do.
Yeah, she's amazing. I think of her as my very, very clever older sister, because whenever it's Twitter, something will have happened and I'm trying to process my own thoughts about it. And then Sophie, obviously several steps ahead of me, will have processed what I think and turned that into three well-crafted tweets. And it makes me feel very relieved that I can then get on with my day, because she's taken away my desire to communicate by doing it better and faster than I would do myself.
So that's the telling error from Sophie Hannah. Let's turn and enjoy Campari for breakfast. Sarah Crowe, tell us a little bit more about this one.
Well, I've loved this book since I saw the title. I just fell in love with the title, Campari for Breakfast.
It just speaks to you. It's one of those, isn't it?
What's not to love? It's great. I have interviewed the author and I asked her about the title, and she said it actually came from a conversation with a friend who'd been on a completely disastrous holiday, one disaster after the other. And he said to her, by the end, we were drinking Campari for breakfast. And that's where she got the idea for the title from. This is a really sweet novel. It's a debut. It's set in the 1980s. And our heroine, Sue Bowl, is only 17 and is full of a sort of a lust for life, a desire to know love. And then her mother commits suicide. Her father very quickly takes up with this hideous woman, Ivana, and Sue doesn't know what to do with herself, so she decides to go and live with her eccentric aunt, Coral, and start working on a novel. Very charming. It sort of has shades of I Capture the Castle, but set in the 80s. So I Capture the Castle crossed with Adrian Mole or Love, Nina.
And again, what's not to like about
what's
that?
What's not to like about
and,
that?
And Sarah Crowe, another interesting character. She'll be known, you mentioned it's her debut, perhaps, but maybe better known to some people already from another theatre, as it were.
Yeah, so she's an actress, an extremely recognisable face. She was in Four Weddings and a Funeral. She is very interesting on the similarities between acting and writing, that they come from the same creative space, that perhaps the desire to inhabit another character, the desire to provoke an emotional reaction from an audience or from a reader is quite similar. And I think that's a very interesting idea, I think. Did make me wonder why, because there aren't that many actors that are
Well, I was going to
novelists.
Ask you about this. I mean, in terms of that transition, because it is a risky strategy. I guess people are familiar with you. They maybe enjoy your work. And some people might say, oh, I'd be a bit wary about, you know, delving into this other realm with its different demands and the different rigours. But you think she makes a fairly decent fist of it?
I do, yes. And we had an interesting chat about how one thing feeds the other. You know, so she says, as she says, being out in the world is great copy. So acting feeds the writing. She wouldn't like to sit alone and scribe. I think that's quite an interesting idea.
It is interesting, because I suppose also acting, one tends to think of it as being a slightly more of a social engagement in terms
yes.
of the professional player.
Yeah.
And maybe writing we think of as a bit of a more of a sort of solo.
Solitary existence.
Another one of these capable people who can turn
well,
their hand
completely.
To anything, perhaps.
I do think it's very modern, actually. I do think it's a very modern thing, isn't it, to have... I mean, in the past, it was really unusual to have a portfolio career, but I'm finding now that more and more people are... You're just having a go at different things, and that's actually more achievable. And doing it well.
It's insufferable when that happens. It makes me feel so inadequate. Let's move on, though, and talk fairly quickly, appropriately enough, about The Quick, this one from Lauren Owen. Give us a quick sort of synopsis of this one.
Yeah, this is great, spooky stuff. Another debut, Victorian England. This is where we follow the fortunes of James and his sister Charlotte, who grow up in a big, strange, dark, damp house in Yorkshire. And then they end up in London, a mysterious and sinister club called the, I think, Aeolus Club.
It sounds sinister already.
It is very sinister. It's a good sinister read. You don't realise till really quite late in the book, though it's all, I'm not doing any, it's not a spoiler from me because it's very clear in all the cover copy that there is a supernatural element to it. But again, I find that quite interesting because you don't know, most of the book isn't about that. And then you realise that actually a lot of the sinisterness behind this club is what it's all about. And the quick is actually how people who are not human refer to humans.
Oh, this does sound...
They talk about us collectively as the Quick.
That sounds rather terrifying. Very, very briefly on this, you do sense that there's rather a lot of competition in this kind of realm. As you said, that's a lot of a Victorian era, sort of almost haunted house genre of its own. This a little more writerly, a good read.
Yes, literary, very grown up literary. You know, if you plotted out the novels, if you plotted out all the vampire stuff on a graph, this would be right at the grown up literary end of it. Admiring quotes from Hilary Mantel and from Kate Atkinson, which is obviously quite a significant endorsing duo.
Absolutely.
And yeah, I really enjoyed it.
And now we can add the name of Kathy Rensenbrick to the approving audience as well. I'm sure that'll make Lauren's day. Kathy Rensenbrick. From the bookseller, thanks very much for coming and sharing your expertise with us here on Midori House today.
It was a pleasure.
And that is just about all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. My special thanks in particular to my guests, James Boyes and Daniela Pellet, and of course also to Kathy Rensenbrink there for sharing her literary insights with us. Today's show was produced by Marco Sippi, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Janie Cho, and our studio manager was Alex Funnell. Next up, after the headlines on Monocle 24, it's The Urbanist, and this week Andrew Tuck is investigating the City District. He'll be asking if we really need to have separate spaces for different industries and cultures, and how you turn a neglected area into an attractive neighbourhood.
I think the acid test for me is that you can stand in Baker Street and have a conversation with someone without having to raise your voice. And I think that's the test for all civil cities.
That's The Urbanist, coming up after the news with Paul Osborne. At 2200 hours, we've got the Monocle Daily, of course. Dominic Reynolds and Emma Nelson will be in the chairs for that one. Midori House will be back at the very same time tomorrow. Tune in for the Friday edition of the show at 1800 hours London time. But for this Thursday edition of Midori House, it's goodbye from me, Tom Edwards. Thank you very much for listening.
The Rolex Mentor and Protégé Arts Initiative sources young artists and brings them together with artistic masters for a year of mentoring. For mentors, it's a year to share their passion and expertise. For protégés, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to observe and work alongside some of the world's greatest artists. 1 year can inspire a lifetime. Rolex.